Welcome to episode 152 of Practical Defense, Firing Blanks. Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I am your host, Alex Addix. This week, we're going to finish off the email we started from Brad in Ohio back in episode 150. But first, there are a few things that I need to catch up on. Things have just been insanely busy around the Palatial Palladium Podcasting Post, meaning my home office. So busy, in fact, that I'm having a hard time deciding what to talk about first. I guess I'll start with a new safety program that we just released. We are proud to announce an active shooter program for schools, businesses, and healthcare facilities. For the longtime listeners, I discussed active shooters back in episode 79. As a refresher, an active shooter is someone who enters a location with the intent to hurt and kill as many people as possible before he or she is stopped. Back in the 80s, this type of workplace violence was called going postal. This program is offered standalone, or it can be incorporated into a larger, comprehensive workplace violence prevention system. The key message is that proper training and planning can reduce the damage inflicted by an active shooter. Instruction on how to respond to an event, evacuation plans, sending and receiving alerts, and dealing with the eventual law enforcement response are all critical aspects of staff protection. Our program educates employees on the nature of the active shooter threat and teaches the latest techniques in responding to an incident with the goal of minimizing the amount of harm to employees. You can find all the details on the Palladium Education website in the Services section. The URL is palladium-education.com. There's also a direct link in the show notes. The next bit of information is more personal in nature. As those following the show on Facebook and Twitter know, I've been having some significant trouble with my left shoulder, and I promised all the details in a show. In fact, the pain has been so severe that I haven't been able to practice in nearly 2 months. Just swinging my arm when walking was painful. So here's the scoop. The day after a 90-minute jiu-jitsu class focused on arm bars, my shoulder really hurt. It hurt like I had damaged something. So I took a few days off to heal. Well, there was only marginal improvement, and after a week, I still had sharp, piercing pains in the joint. Now, from previous experience, this usually means some serious damage. For my years of competitive training, I've learned to distinguish between the types of pain. This had all the earmarks of, crap, I really did something in there. I've had some intermittent pain in my shoulder for the past year, but working out and spending more time on shoulder-specific weights made it go away. Also, there was no specific incident where someone went too far during the practice. I couldn't point to anything specific and say, that is where I hurt myself. I was really puzzled. So, I made an appointment with my doctor, and he ordered x-rays. The x-rays just confused things more. A handful of general practitioners looked at the film and could not make anything out for certain. My shoulder had bone spurs and even a possible break in the upper femur. An orthopedist looked at it and said he didn't see the break, but did see arthritis. All I knew is that I hurt enough that I couldn't train, and I had about 70% mobility. I could bring my elbow up to my shoulder level, but nothing beyond that. So, I was referred to an orthopedist who specialized in shoulders, and he ordered an MRI, and that is when everything went to hell. The MRI called for an injection of contrast dye into the joint to get a better picture. And this was no big deal. In fact, I'd had the same procedure done to my right shoulder 20 years ago when they performed a CAT scan before surgery. No biggie. The dye was a little uncomfortable, and I even fell asleep in the CAT scan machine. So I'm at the hospital, and some doctor I've never met before comes in to inject the dye before the MRI. First, he puts lidocaine into the area to numb it. Now, lidocaine targets the nerve, so the whole area goes dead to pain. Then he goes in with a catheter to inject the dye. So he sticks it in, pops an x-ray to see if it's in the right place, adjusts it, takes another x-ray, adjusts it some more, takes another x-ray. He does this 4 or 5 times. He finally gets the right place, injects what feels like a gallon of fluid into the joint, yanks the catheter out, and I'm off to the MRI. And when I say yank, I meant it was rough enough that I felt it and thought to myself, geez, that certainly wasn't gentle. Then the MRI itself was unexpectedly uncomfortable. I'm a big guy, and CAT scans are tight for me. My shoulders are broad enough that I need to squeeze in there at an odd angle. However, there's been enough room that I've managed to fall asleep in them. Since the MRIs were newer machines, I figured they would be larger and roomier. No. They are smaller. Much smaller. And holy crap, are they loud. They gave me hearing protection before going into the machine. I was scrunched into this machine like a marshmallow into a straw. I had to keep my left shoulder flat on the table for the scan, which meant that my right side was rolling up and off the table onto the right side of this tube. My nose was 2 inches from the ceiling. It was close enough that I had trouble focusing on it. I have never been in such a confined space in my life. And then I had to lie perfectly still for 35 minutes. The tech even told me to breathe shallowly to avoid movement. I used the time to practice meditation. I closed my eyes, controlled my breathing, and focused on my breath, and tried to relax. I stopped and started countless times, and I never got very deep, but it did give me some place to put my brain. Opening my eyes just made me feel claustrophobic, which is something I've actually never felt before. With a discomfort, incredible, heavy, metallic banging noise and tight space, I'm surprised I managed to get into any level of meditation, even if it was brief. After 35 minutes, the tech pulled me out and said he was surprised that I could stand to be in the machine for that long. He then adjusted my shoulder into a new position and shoved me back in for another 10 minutes. Apparently, I hadn't finished cooking yet. When it was all over, I got up, grabbed my stuff, and went home. And that's when things started to go downhill. About an hour after arriving home, the lidocaine started wearing off, and the pain started. 90 minutes after that, I was literally calling for my mommy to drive me to the emergency room. If she hadn't been available, the pain was so severe that I could not drive myself, and I would have had to call 911 for an ambulance to take me in. It was that severe. I have never been in so much pain in my life. I was in so much pain that I felt violent, which for someone like me is not a good thing. My wife of 15 years says she has never seen me in such a state. You know, over the years, I've been hurt in countless ways. I've broken my leg, dislocated my shoulder, torn a knee ligament. I've lost count of how many toes I've broken. I've crushed my index finger. I've had over 60 stitches, and nothing has ever come close to this amount of pain. I have a really high pain tolerance. Normally, when I hurt myself, my reaction's, oh, crap, I just really hurt myself. And I deal with the pain such as it is. The last time I broke a toe was in Hapkido practice. I was doing a spinning kick, and my little toe got caught in a wrinkle on the mat. My foot rotated, and my little toe didn't. I heard the snick of the break, I felt some pain, and thought, well, I just broke my toe. Nothing I can do about it. And then continued with class. I showed up the next day with my foot black and blue, and toes wrapped. I'm just trying to put the amount of pain I experienced into context. I could not breathe, it hurt so much. In the ER, they shot me with some Demerol and gave me a prescription for Percocet. The Demerol let me catch my breath and drop my blood pressure from over 200 down to the 130s. And those are real numbers, not an exaggeration. The Percocet took most of the pain away and put me to sleep. I slept for nearly 24 hours straight, sitting in a lounge chair in the living room because I couldn't lie down. I slept sitting up in the chair for several days afterwards. It was pretty miserable. So that was all a few weeks ago. I still have pain, and it's far less than it was, but still twice as much as before I went in for the MRI on November 18th. About 95% of my mobility has returned, and I'm actually going to return to my first martial arts class in nearly 2 months on Monday. Now, all of that nonsense was to return a diagnosis of arthritis in my shoulder. There were some micro tears and some tendons, but that's not the major issue. My orthopedist prescribed me some non-steroid anti-inflammatory medication and said I could return to practice. He said there would be pain, but it's not hurting anything or causing any further damage. I'll just have to deal with it. I can do that. He also said that the arthritis was from my years of heavy swimming. Working out 4.5 hours a day, 6 days a week for over 6 years apparently has consequences, even if it's just swimming. He said the type of repetitive overhead motions of high-performance athletes cause this type of injury. He sees it in swimmers, baseball pitchers, and javelin throwers. You know, of all the competitive sports I've done in my life, you'd think that swimming was the gentle one. So I'm only 40 years old, and now I have arthritis. You know, I keep telling people, I'm not old. I've just done lots of stuff. And I have the scars to prove it. The whole MRI pain incident was because of that SOB who injected the dye into my joint. Now, apparently he did something when he was repeatedly poking around in there. My orthopedist referred to it as multiple passes into the joint. I don't know what he used, but it felt like a copper-bladed pipe cleaner. 2 weeks later, I still have nice purple bruises on my shoulder. And that's enough of that. I'll let you know if anything else comes up with my shoulder after I practice this week. But before we move on to the reason that most of you listen to the show, I have one last announcement. We are running a fundraiser to help cover the costs of this show. Julie Green, author of Defy the Bad Guy, Powerful Practical Self-Defense Strategies for Every Woman, has donated signed copies of her book. I've created a special donation page for the event. It's alexhaddix.com/defy. That's alexhaddix.com/DEFY. For any single donation over $20, the supporter will receive a signed copy of Julie's book with a custom inscription. When you complete the form, be certain to include your mailing address and any custom note that you would like. Again, the URL is alexhaddix.com/defy. Okie dokie, now on to the main part of the show with a question from Brad.
A woman is approximately 10 times more likely to be successfully raped when she doesn't have a gun, according to a Department of Justice study. This explains why women in the United States use firearms about 200,000 times a year to stop sexual assaults. It also explains why more than 40% of women own or already have access to a firearm. So why do some politicians want to disarm women? Maybe rape isn't a serious enough crime in their minds. Or maybe they don't want to stare down the wrong end of your barrel.
Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Welcome back. Brad from Ohio has an excellent question regarding gun safety and how to load a firearm for personal protection. He writes, I would like to ask you a question regarding gun ownership and safety. Over the past couple of years, I have looked into purchasing a firearm for home protection, but have put it off for the time being to abide by my wife's wishes of not keeping a gun in the house while we have little ones running around. However, I have numerous conversations with friends who do own firearms for home protection, and one piece of advice I received has struck me as an oddity, and I would like to get the opinion of someone more experienced in this matter. Quote, always keep the gun loaded with a first round chambered with a blank, end quote. The logic behind this is that if someone is prowling through your house, you can fire off a shot anywhere in the house as a warning. This will let the intruder know you are armed and while at the same time allowing you to put your family in a centralized location, as well as arouse a neighbor who could hopefully notify the police of gunshots going off in your house. Then, if the intruder still does not vacate the premises, comes towards you, or possesses some other sort of threat, you're justified in using lethal force as you have already provided a warning that you are armed. On top of that, my friend swears by this in the situation where a child gets a hold of the gun and accidentally squeezes the trigger. Rather than discharging a potential lethal round, the gun will discharge a blank, potentially saving someone's life, as well as notifying others in the house that something was going on. However, the big gaping hole in this logic I see, and have yet to get a satisfactory answer on, is what if you need that first shot to be a debilitating shot? Given the results of the Tula drill, the 21 feet or 7 meter rule, an intruder from a close distance could potentially disable you or potentially strip the gun away before you got the gun out and got that second shot off. So my question is, what do you think of this advice? Is it something I should look into doing when I finally purchase a firearm, or do the risks outweigh the benefits? Thanks, Brad. You know, that is a really interesting question. There are a lot of facets to this issue, and I'm going to go into each one of them in turn. But first, I will give you my short answer. I think it's a bad idea. Now, I'll spend a little while justifying my position. A critical point when it comes to blanks that everyone forgets is that blanks are not safe. Let me repeat that. Blanks are not safe. Even with blanks, there is a gas plume that escapes the end of the barrel. This is hot, compressed gas along with debris and unburned powder that comes shooting out of there at high speeds. Gas plumes fired from blanks have killed people. Occasionally, you read in the news about people accidentally killing themselves with blanks. Usually, it's a bunch of idiot kids playing Russian roulette, and the poor kid that gets the blank and puts the gun to his temple and then pulls a trigger dies from brain injury. There are occasionally actors and stuntmen who die or are seriously injured from being too close to a muzzle when firing blanks during filming. One actor in the 80s died when he shot himself with a blank in his dressing room. He was showing off to his friends and said, "Hey, watch this," and then grabbed a gun loaded with blanks, put it to his head, and pulled the trigger. He died 3 days later from his injuries. Now, a young child who gets a hold of a firearm loaded with blanks may not put it to his or her head and pull the trigger. However, if an unintended child gets a hold of your firearm, you have really screwed up, and a blank in the chamber is not going to save you. The gas expelled from the barrel can still do serious damage to a child. It can remove fingers, rip arms, and God forbid if the child looks down the barrel and accidentally pulls a trigger. It's just really horrible to even think about. Blanks are not safety devices and should never be treated as safety devices. Always treat blanks with the same respect as a live round. Now, that should be enough reason alone not to put any trust in blanks. But I have more. Blanks are dirty. They will gum up your firearm faster than anything I've ever used. When I was in the Army, we trained with blanks in our M16s. I have never had so many failures as when we were using blanks. The powder just went everywhere in the firearm and gunked it all to hell. I remember during one exercise, I had a complete failure that could not be remedied during the run. I finished the exercise by yelling, "Bang, bang, bang," to indicate to the instructor that I was firing. So what does that mean in a self-defense scenario? Well, if your first round is a blank, you have just handicapped your firearm. There is now crud in there that can negatively impact the performance of your firearm when you need it most. If you're pulling your firearm for self-defense, you are chest deep in the absolute worst-case nightmare position and you need to rely on a defensive weapon. After a blank round, it can't be trusted. The vast majority of blanks you buy commercially do not have the power to properly cycle a firearm. Automatic handguns need a minimum amount of powder to work properly. Blanks are not made to that specification. They're made to go bang, not push lead down a barrel at high velocity. If you look at the fine print on most blank ammunition sites, you'll see disclaimers. Here's an example of one. Using this particular blank ammunition will cause the real firearm to fire single shot only. Also, a certain amount of debris will project from the end of the barrel. And that's a direct quote. What they use in movies and by the military are special loads, and they are not normally available commercially. Often in the movies, they are hand-loaded by a firearm specialist hired for that specific job. Now, at this point, after firing your blank, you have introduced gunk into your firearm and then caused a failure. So instead of a firearm, you now have a blunt instrument. Now, one way around this specific failure type is to keep a revolver for personal protection. A revolver is not subject to the feeding problems associated with blanks. However, you are introducing other issues with revolvers, such as limited capacity and slow, complicated reloading. Now, certainly, you can become proficient and fast at reloading a revolver, but it takes a lot of practice. But, you know, this is not a discussion on the merits of automatics versus revolvers. Next, unless you're firing military-grade blanks, the noise made does not sound like a live round. Blanks sound more like a firecracker than a real firearm. Also, even with real firearms, there is a small chance that your neighbor is even going to hear the gun go off. If you live in an apartment or condominium, perhaps. However, if you live in a standalone home that shares no walls with anyone else, they're not going to hear it. Even in the remotest of chances a neighbor hears it, the person will most likely chalk it up to a neighborhood kid lighting off a firecracker down the block. Only someone who knows the difference between the sound of a firecracker and a gun will even register the difference. The walls of your home are insulated against heat, cold, and sound. The same holds true for your neighbor's home. You can't count on your neighbors to call for help if a firearm discharges. Will everyone in the home hear it? Hell yes. Guns going off in confined spaces are loud. Now, as you alluded to, if you're in serious enough danger that you need to grab your firearm for self-protection, you don't want a blank. You're beyond that point. If you grab your firearm, your life is in significant and immediate danger. You do not want to have to remember to cycle the firearm to remove a blank. You'll be lucky if you remember to release the safety first. Here's a quick side story about safeties. I was on a boar hunt 2 years ago. We spotted a large group of big pigs across a ravine. There was another herd of smaller pigs there as well. Now, we set up our position, expecting the pigs to move a certain direction. The smaller pigs moved first, and we were just going to hold tight and let them pass, and then wait for the really big ones to move in and take one. Well, the smaller group did not move in the direction that we expected. Instead of heading down and into the ravine, they crossed the ravine and up onto the plateau where we were sitting. We kept quiet and motionless, hoping that they would just pass us by. Now, boars are nearly blind, but they have a great hearing and great smell. One good-sized male broke from the pack and came within 20 feet of where I was kneeling on the ground. I froze. I was sitting cross-legged with my rifle across my legs. The boar saw me, but couldn't figure me out. He put up his nose and sniffed the air. He looked again at me and then started grunting. Then the grunting turned to a full alarm. We'd been made. Our guide jumped up and yelled at me to take the one that made us. It was a male and good-sized, about 180 pounds. The ones that we originally wanted that were across the ravine were over 250 pounds. At this point, we had lost the big boys, and this one was still worth taking. So I popped to a kneeling position and drew a bead on this boar as he sprinted away from me, bobbing and weaving through the grass. I squeezed the trigger and heard a tremendous click. Since I was not ready to take the shot, my safety was still on. I remembered that we wanted the other group of pigs, not this one, so I wasn't ready to take the shot. It was really quiet. The guide was yelling and making noise to distract the pig, and all the pigs were squealing, but all I heard was a nearly silent click. I knew what I'd done, and without shifting my field of view, I flipped off the safety and then took the pig. It was the most difficult shot I have ever taken. Even the guide was impressed and said that it was one of the best shots that he had seen. That pig was a freaking acrobat. The whole event took less than 4 seconds, but it felt like 4 minutes. Afterwards, my brother-in-law asked me why I didn't take the shot. I said I took 2 shots. The first one was with the safety on. Because of good training, proper practice, and proper form, he couldn't even tell that I'd squeezed the trigger the first time. They say that in a self-defense situation, the loudest sound in the room is the click when the gun fails to fire. After my experience on that hunt, I can certainly believe it. In my home, I keep a self-defense firearm loaded with a round in the chamber and the safety on. However, unlike my hunting rifle, I practice removing the safety with my self-defense firearm repeatedly. It is now instinctual for me to remove the safety when I draw from a holster or just aim. I store my handgun in a safe with a biometric lock. It takes a fingerprint to open it. There is no combination to try and no keys to find. It is the most secure lock I could find to keep children out of it. So to answer your final question, I see no benefit at all to keeping a blank round in the chamber. I see only problems. Thanks again, Brad, for sending those items in. They made for great discussions, and I hope I sufficiently answered your questions.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
When hurricanes strike, people lose belongings, their homes, hope. this hurricane season is predicted to be severe. American Red Cross volunteers stand ready. You can help. Your $50 click on redcross.org can feed and shelter a child for a day. Text Red Cross to 90999 to give $10. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS and your $25 gift can make sure someone won't go hungry for the day. Every single donation brings hope. Text message and data rates may apply.
So when it comes to using blanks in your self-defense firearm, blanks are not safety devices. People have been killed and seriously injured by blanks. Blanks are dirty and will gunk up your firearm. Blanks will negatively impact the reliability of your firearm. Blanks will not properly cycle your firearm. Commercially available blanks do not have the power to properly cycle a firearm, meaning you are introducing a failure after the first shot. Commercially available blanks do not sound like real gunshots. They sound more like firecrackers. If you're in the position that you need a firearm for self-defense, you do not want a blank as your first round. Firearms must always be treated as serious and deadly. If you reach for one, you must be willing to use it. It is not a game and not ever to be taken lightly. If you're not willing to use it properly and appropriately, do not purchase one for self-defense. And along those lines, do not forget that our Masoud Ayoub seminar is fast approaching. It is less than 2 months away at this point. The seminar will help keep you out of jail if you're ever in the position to use force to defend yourself against a criminal attack. The lessons taught in this 20-hour course can be applied to empty-handed defense, less-than-lethal defense, and lethal force. If you ever plan on defending yourself, you need to understand what to do, what you can do, and how you should explain the event afterwards. Masoud Ayoub is one of the nation's leading experts on this topic. It is not something that you should miss. The URL to sign up is alexhaddix.com/mag20. That's alexhaddix.com/mag20. If you have any tips you would like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe. Practical Defense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions, commentary, and topic suggestions, send an email to podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexhaddix.com. Music by Kevin MacLeod.